Today I want to ask and talk about a series of questions, all revolving around this one central question. What makes you uncomfortable? Why is that important to know? What makes you uncomfortable? What makes me uncomfortable? What makes other people uncomfortable? The importance is that our beliefs about what makes us uncomfortable are the beliefs that govern the way we think, feel, speak, and act. We will do things to avoid discomfort. So if we understand what makes us uncomfortable, we'll also be able to get at the root of the information that provided the ingredients for those beliefs, for those habit patterns, and our approach to life. We could say this: stress makes you and me uncomfortable. Stress is implicated in 85 to 95% of all illnesses, depending on who you speak to, and depending on whose point of view it is about illness and health and stress and so on. We know that the stress is going to be phrased in different ways. For instance, doctors and researchers with backing from pharmaceutical companies, they're going to be talking about the chemicals of stress. They'll be talking about adrenaline, cortisol, and what chemicals you can use so you don't notice it, and so on. So a lot of people think in terms of stress being a chemical process. Other people could say, well, you know, I want to talk about the allocation or misallocation of energy resources in the body under stress, where the resources are now devoted to the big muscles in the arms and the legs for the activities we refer to as fight or flight. And the non-urgent activities, cell multiplication, growth, digestion, normal blood flow, higher cognitive thought, the immune system, all these non-urgent processes are deprioritized. Now, that's another way to look at it. And based upon my recent studies, I would say that stress constricts the electron flow that is normal in the body. And that results, because of that restriction of electron flow, it results in the cells being voltage starved. Another way I could say that is there is voltage deficiency on a cellular level. Now all of a sudden this, I'm uncomfortable, could be any one or all of our 10 trillion cells having that survival issue get triggered because of the lack of voltage. The definition of stress that I use, and it developed by Hans Selye, who was considered to be the father of modern stress study, is that stress is a nonspecific response to a demand placed upon the body. So we have a demand, but we don't have a specific response to it. So the energy that is starting to mobilize to respond to the demand, because there is no direction given to it, just swirls and whirls. I see it as a tornado that is damaging to the body when it's prolonged over time. If we contrast a couple of concepts, openness with restriction, we might recognize how we create this condition of voltage deficiency. We are naturally open. Bruce Lipton would call this phase, this mode, this condition as the growth mode. Growth mode is when the body is functioning normally. We believe we're safe, our needs are going to be met or are being met. The large-scale threats that we can't handle are absent from our environment. And so like an open door or an open window, the circulation of electrons is more complete, since it's not interfered with, it's not restricted by fear and us having a reaction to a threat. Under stress, though, it's when we perceive that demand is a potential threat. You know, we're asked to do something that we, for one reason or another, think we are not up to, then we naturally and physiologically tighten up in self-protection. And Bruce Lipton calls it just that, the self-protect mode. And you can imagine this like a closed door or a closed window. Now, the circulation of energy, the circulation of electrons, is not as free as when we were in the growth mode. The goal of energy healing modalities is to reduce the number and the intensity of our perceptions of threats that send us into the restricted self-protect mode. If we can change how we perceive environmental signals more frequently as benign, less frequently as threats, we're going to be allowing ourselves to stay in the growth mode. We're not really working on the threats, you know, those things that are out there, the problem people in our lives, the problem conditions in our lives. We're working on our perceptions. This is an inside job. It's all about the way we're processing information. Studies have shown, and it's well known anecdotally, that tiredness leads to missed emotions and poor decision-making. Tiredness is not really a state of caffeine deficiency or high fructose corn syrup deficiency or nicotine deficiency, although people who are experiencing tiredness seem to think that that approach to enhancing their energy is workable. It's not. Tiredness is really an electron deficiency. Another way to say the same thing, it's in the cells, it's an oxygen deficiency. When the oxygen goes down, the voltage in the cell goes down. So how much voltage do we need on a purely physical level? Well, the studies have said that the voltage of normal functioning cells in a human body ranges from minus 20 to minus 25 millivolts. The amount of voltage needed for healing is greater. It requires more energy, which makes sense that that would be necessary to repair or to produce or fix some condition that is malperforming or malfunctioning. So that's a physical level. But if I wanted to talk about the perceptual level, it's a different story. Our beliefs about ourselves and our perceptions of demands can lead us to think, feel, speak, and act to that demand as if we have enough energy to respond effectively to it. Or we could have beliefs that say to us, we should think, feel, speak, and act as if we don't have enough energy to respond to that demand. You can hear the difference in those. One, we're in an empowered state, and the other is we're in a disempowered state. Like, if we think and feel we don't have enough energy, now that demand, that thing that needs to be done, needs to be thought about, needs to be talked about, is a threat. We will go into the self-protect mode. We will restrict our normal electron flow. And our body will automatically start to prepare to fight it or to run away from that threat. In the United States, and I suppose this is true everywhere in the world now, is at our airports, we've got various levels of threats. Those things, I guess, range from the green to the yellow to orange to red. We've been in the orange alert state for so long, I guess we're pretty much limited now going from orange to red. We're not backing off, apparently. So, but if we talk about our physical bodies with its alert states, the state that we're most trying to avoid is what I'll call dead. We could create a spectrum. If you drew a horizontal line and go, okay, I'm going to just populate this line with some concepts as my alert state opportunities. Dead, well, I'll put that on the left edge of it because that's pretty much it. And for other people who want to think there are things worse than that, you might want to put hell further to the left of that. Or you could put, you know, discomfort somewhere on there. You could write pain somewhere. You could put suffering. You could put awkwardness. You could put embarrassment and so on. Wherever you felt that those things needed to go, you could arrange them from terrible up to the least damaging, the least threatening to you. And you would go, oh, yeah. It really is a spectrum as compared to an on and off switch. You know, I'm either comfortable or uncomfortable. Yeah, that's a kind of a very limited way of seeing it. I think we can look at it in a greater depth than that. What makes you uncomfortable? I just had this experience of getting an email the other day from a, quotes, informed Christian. And I realized that the content made me uncomfortable. I'll blame it on the content of the email. made me uncomfortable. Of course, we already know it's perceptions that make us comfortable or uncomfortable. And I thought about it. I said, maybe this is my need to be right that was threatened and activated in this email. Because the email said, this person was right and I was wrong. They were quoting the Old Testament and, you know, God's word, and this is the way it was, and it couldn't be any variation from that. So it seems pretty easy to believe that I would perceive a threat when people say I'm not right. I think we all do that, right? That's not a good feeling. It could be valuable to us, but generally speaking, we're going to think that makes us uncomfortable. So what's the real challenge? What's the real opportunity here? And it would be for me to change my perception about the importance of somebody seeing or saying or agreeing that I'm right on anything. Oftentimes, that's a non-issue for me because I can present stuff. It's like, here, for your consideration, whether you believe it or not, that's not my decision. That's your decision. And that's completely cool. And that's true of all these Sunday talks and coaching and so on. But here's an important idea. It is this vulnerability that we believe our individuality has to other people's inputs. How delicate, how brittle, how subject to pain are we based upon other people's inputs? That's a success factor. The answer to that question determines a relative level of success potential, because if we're very, very sensitive to what anybody thinks about us or could think about us, we will start governing our behaviors based upon whatever we're conjecturing they could be thinking about us. So if my expression or your expression or anybody else's expression is held captive by somebody else's input or possible input, then we would be severely disadvantaged. It's like, oh, I'm not going to put my foot on the gas pedal and go forward or make progress in my life because somebody else might have bad feelings about it. Like, wow. You know this, if we were to look at high visibility people that we see, you know, celebrities or political figures or so on, we know that those people are subjected to unbelievable amounts of negative input. But somehow they have managed to perceive that input differently than you and I would. For our purposes, I think that if we could look at our needs, our own needs, and identify how we become uncomfortable when we think they're threatened or not going to be met or have been violated, it would give us great things to heal. I'm going to use this way of framing needs that I find very convenient. I call it Sufuli, S-F-U-L-I plus two. Survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, the need to be right, the need to look good, / get approval. That's going to be the needs framework in this conversation. We could surmise that these needs, if they've been threatened while we were in utero, it is very likely that we're going to come out sensitive to them being threatened. Our alarm system has already been developed prenatally by the imprints we would have received from my mother that says, uh-oh, this need is not going to be met, and this need might not be met, and this need might. Now, we're going to come out all geared up to be vigilant. So you can look at what happened in utero. You can look at what happened at the birth process itself and any kind of anxieties that might have been delivered relative to our needs and what happened in our early childhood. If we can become aware of those imprinted energies from utero, birth, early childhood, we're going to know what is governing us today and what we tend to believe makes us uncomfortable. Being imprinted prenatally is a good idea. This is where and when a child starts getting taught about life. If the mother is anxious about her survival, it could have value to the child because the child is already getting training that says survival is precarious. This is natural to our way of life. Now, that's a cool thing if you're a cave child and it could help that person survive because they come out already geared for life. Okay, this is a hard survival being a cave person, and it's easy enough to see how prenatal imprinting could be a very high value in a scenario like that. On the other hand, if the mother's anxiety was due to her job or her husband's job being eliminated in a downsizing or an outsourcing, then that training being given to the baby that says how threatening the world can be might be a distinct disadvantage of that child. That, in this context, in this world, it's not the same difficult, harsh life that a cave person would normally experience. That certainly is true. Our culture, not all cultures on the planet are experiencing that. But if we come out with this mindset, this energy set, this neurochemical orientation toward anxiety or fear or depression that we would have learned in utero, if we know that, it gives us something that's much easier to heal. Let's say our happiness is directly related to our ability to get our needs met. Right? That's it. The more effective I am at getting my needs met, survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, need to be right, need to look good, get approval, the more effective I am at that, the happier I'm going to be. Okay. But we want challenges in life. We want to know how to overcome them as well. We don't want to just be laying around on a couch eating bonbons, watching TV. Because if things were too easy, we're not going to be inspired to develop our strengths. And we become very bored very easily. And then what we do to overcome the boredom is liable to be not that productive. But if things are too difficult, then it's easy enough for us to become discouraged and depressed and think we can't really make an impact. We can't do stuff. We don't have the ability to change our conditions. I think we can start to look at things in a different way and maybe recognize exactly what's going on in our perceptions. Let's take a look at what I've referred to in previous Sunday talks as the things that we try to manage. Life is about us managing matter, solid objects, energy, not solid things, space, and time. If we were to think, you know what? Since life is about managing those things, I want to be effective at managing that. Well, let's just talk about that a little bit more. What matter do we try to manage in order to ensure our survival? And if you just think about all the solid things, you know, you go, oh, I got a car, I got a house, I got a refrigerator, I got all this, I have food, I have all this stuff, you know, TVs and computers and papers and chairs and desks and, I'm trying to manage all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. In the context of survival, you could say, well, managing what matter, managing which of those things makes you uncomfortable? You could take a look at it and say, the acquisition of what matter makes you uncomfortable. The protection of what matter makes you uncomfortable. Because you have a relationship with matter. You have a relationship with solid objects. And you go like, I'm up to my ears in clutter. Obviously not effective at this moment of managing matter. It's like, why? What would happen? It's the reason for not managing that matter is a perception of discomfort. I don't know where to put it, which is I might not do it right, or I might throw away something that I will need in 7 years, or on and on and on. You could start to look at that because it is discomfort. There's an energy of discomfort that is repelling us. It's like a force field. Oh, procrastination. There's an energy of discomfort around that. There is some belief that this is making me uncomfortable. I can't approach it. I can't do it. I can't think about it. You go, These ideas relative to energy, about how we manage matter, energy, space, and time, is like my earliest training, Oh, in utero. So, let me ask, was our mother positive or negative or neutral about her conditions? What was life like just before our conception and for that nine-month period and maybe for the first 6, 8, 10, 12 years of our lives? Was she positive, negative, or neutral about her conditions? Was she able to meet her needs regarding matter? Was she able to manage the solid things in her life? Was she able to manage energy? Was she able to manage the space, her homes, all of that stuff? Was she able to manage her own time? I'm thinking anybody with more than one child, and even just one child, is going to go, 24 hours a day is not enough time. I can't manage to get in all the things that need to be done. So if you add more than one child to that scenario, you could go, wow, time decreased relative to that. A lot of demands, a lot of requirements, and very little time. And very easy to get overwhelmed. And then there's insufficient time, there's insufficient energy, and we go into the self-protect mode and make things even more difficult for ourselves. Consider the second question. Was your mother effective, ineffective, or neutral with regard to acquiring energy? Taking it in, protecting it, translating it, expressing it, releasing it, what no longer served her, and coming to a sense of closure. Was she ever able to get to the sense of the of closure? I'm complete. I'm finished. I'm okay. Boom. Let me go on to the next thing. And if you thought about that, how your mother was managing matter, energy, space, and time again, you were like, All of these inputs really represent our early training. Here's a third question. Did your mother consider herself to be effective, ineffective, or neutral at meeting other people's needs, especially other people in the family? Her feelings about herself would be projected onto you as a fetus, as a baby being born, and as a child in the family. If you got that she was ineffective, if she felt that, you would be getting bombarded with those feelings. And you could turn around and go, oh, wow, that might explain why I have these beliefs about... Yeah, it would. I like to talk about human activity in a framework I refer to as the 12 worlds. I think that all of our activities could fit into one and more of these 12 categories, and here they are. And they're relatively easy to remember if you start above your head, right? You imagine spiritual, mental, emotional, physical, family, career, financial, social, leisure, community, political, and maintenance. If you look at what you do in a given day, you will see that that activity fits into one or more of those worlds. What's really cool, if you're doing something and you recognize, wow, I got this activity, and it's actually impacting three or four of my worlds. You know, going out to dinner with friends that is going to involve a business conversation, you could say, well, it's a physical thing, it's a social thing, it's a leisure thing, and it's a business career thing. Wow, this is great. And it's mentally stimulating. Oh, I impacted that world. Five worlds. How fantastic. Then you go, gee, I got a lot of value out of that experience. It's because we made an impact in more than just one world. So if you look at those 12 worlds, you say, here's a question. In which of those areas did your mother feel that she did not have enough energy to be successful or to be effective? What did she believe? Because her beliefs, when we were in utero, become our beliefs. They are both of ours. There's no way to separate and keep her feelings about life separate from a developing baby, because those feelings are going to be producing neurochemicals, and they are going to be delivered through the placenta into this baby. This baby is going to be fed this neurochemical programming. In the very simplest sense, our problems are due to the perception that we don't have or we won't have enough energy, period. I'm going to repeat that. Our problems are due to our perception that we don't have or won't have enough energy, period. It's a perception. If we saw a threat such as a free saber-toothed tiger roaming around, we would feel fear and stress. The reason why is because we would perceive that I don't have enough energy, I don't have enough resources, I don't have enough speed or strength, or however I wanted to frame not enough energy to deal effectively with that tiger. If, on the other hand, we were Superman or Superwoman, we wouldn't feel that stress because we wouldn't have had that thought. We would respond to that demand as, we got to capture the saber-toothed tiger. We got to save it. We got to protect it. We got to grab it and fly it to a zoo or a compound or an area where it was safe and people would be safe. Wouldn't have been, because the super person didn't perceive that he or she didn't have enough energy. She or he has enough energy, and that's why we refer to them as supermen and superwomen, right? Got enough energy. So how would human beings deal with this hypothetical threat in which it would be real easy for us to perceive that we don't have enough energy? Well, there are ways that we do it now, right? And I think this is another place we could use the energy model that I refer to, talk about energy acquisition, energy protection, energy translation, energy release, that is releasing what no longer serves us, and then coming to closure, where we have a sense of completeness. Boom. And so it's not an open switch, it's not an open wound, it's not a pot simmering on the stove. When we think we don't have enough energy, first order of business is we seek to acquire it. And so, I think this is real telling that when Obama was elected as president, the sale of guns increased. The Republicans had so scared the population, even though it was a huge victory in terms of the number of people who voted for him, other people ran out and bought guns to protect themselves. So a person would buy a gun and carry a gun because it's, this gives me a form of energy that if I had to protect myself, I could cause a desirable effect by shooting something. For some people, having the power to kill living things is desirable to them, and it makes them feel more secure, less stressed, but I don't really understand how that all comes into play because I'm not in that situation. But clearly this person says, I feel like I have enough energy now that I have a gun in my car or in my pocket or in my home. So that person goes, it helped my perception that I now have enough energy. The trouble is, the power belongs to the gun, not to the individual. So it didn't really change that person's perception. They just added some substitute to make up for the shortfall. They chose something out there as the solution to their perceptual problem. And the problem is not out there. Here's what we do, too, to deal with this. We pass laws that limit the use of energy by some people and things. And we specifically pass those that give us more energy, that is, the power to act, while we try to make those laws have power to limit how other people can act. So we reduce other people's power to act while increasing our power to act. We contain other people's energies. Right? We build fences, we build walls, we build prisons, we create wars, we segregate, we ostracize. We do all kinds of things to isolate us from other people. Our main perceptions and our main reactions to those perceptions of not enough energy, and I capitalize those, I see this not enoughness as a condition. Capital N, not capital E, enough, capital E, energy, not enough energy. So If we still think we have some causative capability, we're going to try to acquire it in various forms, and we're going to try to limit the energy of others by various means. You can see human behavior act out those two statements all the time. How much energy is enough energy? Well, I suppose that really is contingent upon the ego of the person in question. That's kind of like asking, how rich is rich enough? How powerful is powerful enough? How much attention is enough attention? How much food is enough food? You know, there are a lot of answers to those questions. The behaviors that we display are directly connected to our beliefs about enough energy or not enough energy. We eat, sleep, talk, drink, work, read, exercise, create, hold back, earn, spend, on and on and on, based upon our beliefs of enough energy or not enough energy. As a result of this talk, I would love it if you would consider this concept. Is that trigger, is that switch, enough energy, not enough energy, keeps getting triggered before you undertake any kind of activity? You're going to be amazed as your awareness grows and as your power grows to create what you want. So how do we get more energy? We use our mouths, our hands, our five senses. You know, we see, we hear, we touch, we smell, we taste, and we think. Thinking is like attaching a tractor beam, like a Star Trek kind of thing, a tractor beam that connects to some object of our attention, of course, and allows us to control it and to bring it to us, or to maintain a certain distance if that's what we prefer. It is in our best interest to acquire, protect, translate, express, release, and come to closure regarding energy. And our beliefs about the availability of enough energy or not enough energy are going to govern how we approach those activities. Another way to see our individual belief systems in action is to notice how we go about meeting our needs. If you just imagine now that our needs could be like seven gauges on the dashboard of our lives, right? You see these in sort of a car. You can imagine them inside of the cockpit of an airplane or on a boat, or, you know, okay, got these seven gauges, yeah. Survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, the need to be right, the need to look good, get approval. Ah, okay, those are the labels of those seven gauges. Yep. So how are they arranged on the dashboard? Well, I suppose that's based upon your experience early in your life and my experiences early in my life, because we're going to have a certain level of sensitivity that says these are more important, these are less important, these have been more threatened, so I really, really got to keep an eye on this gauge. I need to make that gauge bigger so it gets more focus of my attention, and that gauge can be smaller. It's less of a deal for me. You could just imagine now our vigilance toward those things are predetermined. They come from imprints, come from birth, come from early childhood experiences, and come from our understanding, comes from our awareness, comes from what we've learned in various venues like church and school and on the street corners with playing and hanging out with friends. It's like, yeah. If you knew which of those seven was most uncomfortable when it was threatened, you would go, oh, wow, this really does have a huge amount of control over my life. In a car, you know, we've got lots of different alerts. My car, there's a signal that will go off if there any tire has a lower pressure than a certain range. The other day, a headlight burned out, and my dashboard told me that I have a gas gauge, so I can see if gasoline level gets too low. I know that there's an energy or engine temperature thermometer that tells me if the temperature of the car gets too hot. And there's a gauge that tells me what the outdoor temperature is when I'm driving inside the car, and I can tell what temperature I have the air conditioning set to. So, how sensitive are we to threats to any or all of our needs is really an individual pattern. It's you would want to identify that. Your sensitivity to being uncomfortable in one of those areas or all of those areas tells you where you're going to maneuver on your path of life and where you're definitely not going to go. Are we uncomfortable being responsible for the meeting of our own needs, taking action to have those needs met? Or do we believe that our needs can't be met? They haven't been met in the past, can't be met in the future. How comfortable are you right now with this? How comfortable are you with your survival? That's a real big deal. Now, this is not just third world country concerns today, because people are losing jobs and homes and all kinds of stuff. How comfortable are you with your level of freedom, usefulness, love? Love is your giving it and receiving it, sowing it and reaping it, your identity, which is ever-changing. How comfortable are you with it the way it is now? And need to be right? How comfortable or uncomfortable are you? And you need to look good, get approval. How's that going? How comfortable, uncomfortable are you? How comfortable was our mother regarding her needs when she was pregnant with us? How comfortable was our father regarding his needs when we were in utero? How comfortable were our mother and father with their ability to meet the needs of any children that existed before us and us when we were in utero? What did they feel about their capability to rise to the occasion and deliver the energy necessary for us? Here's the real answer to the question, what makes you uncomfortable? Your belief that you don't have enough energy is what makes you uncomfortable. It's what makes me uncomfortable. It's what makes all of us. Our beliefs that we don't have enough energy, that's what causes our feeling uncomfortable. And that belief that we don't have enough energy is what governs our life and our thinking, our feeling, our speaking, and our acting. But here's the thing, that belief that we don't have enough energy is supposed to make us uncomfortable. It's a survival tool. If we become aware that, I'm not comfortable, we will then be inspired to take action to reduce our discomfort. If we didn't recognize that we're uncomfortable and the discomfort mounts and mounts and mounts until it's extreme, we might have already lost the ability to take the necessary actions to improve the situation. That could negate our survival. This is one of the issues with frostbite. Is a person can get frostbite but not know it until it's too late, and then it's like, whoops, now what? You've got to amputate your toes or your fingers or your ears or your nose. It's like, oh, I wish I had known that a little earlier. Well, yeah, exactly. So to be able to respond to that alert effectively earlier, really a very big survival thing. But it is important for us to understand that the perception that we don't have enough energy to think, to feel, to speak, and act effectively is made up. It is made up. It's only true because we believe it's true. It's a perception. We can change the perception, and if we change it to we have enough energy, we're going to approach our lives, the things that we want to do or think about or feel about or speak about or engage with, differently. When we're faced down with a situation that requires thinking or feeling or speaking and acting, we can allow this energy that we need to meet this demand or excel at it to come to us, can come to us and through us, and we deliver it to the object of our attention. We have to think and make decisions instead of avoiding or fighting it. And the way to do that is we can draw the energy to us that makes the better decision available to our awareness. And our awareness improves when we're in the growth mode, and it gets worse when we're in a self-protect mode. So when we allow an electron flow, we're better off, we're served. and we can bring this energy into us. If we're faced with a situation that triggers us to go into a lower emotional state, shame, apathy, grief, fear, lust, anger, or pride, instead of accepting that emotion as the decision maker, well, I'm afraid that means I can't do something or I have to do something, we go, whoa, wait. We can look at the vibrational connection that we have to that situation and know that we can bring light, L-I-G-H-T, capital L or lowercase l, to that. And we can shift our perception of the threat and make ourselves more capable of dealing with it effectively because we would have allowed this energy to come to us and through us. When we've got to speak our truth or otherwise express ourselves verbally, in writing, in the emails, or a novel or whatever, we can access the energy that will allow us to align with the values that are important to us. So instead of reacting out of instinct or ego, where everything is a threat, we got to fight it or run away from it, we go, whoa, wait. Let me bring in higher awareness. And that way we won't be driven to attack or to run. This idea that we can take action when we need to, we can draw in the energy so the better actions become available to our awareness. We can improve our thinking. Now, all of a sudden, the menu of choices seems to get populated with, oh, that wasn't on there before. I thought there was only fight and flight. And now I could look at it from this angle, this angle, this angle. And what we're really doing here is adding a higher level of control to our behaviors and our thoughts and our feelings and our words instead of letting instinct control our actions. It's so much better to have higher awareness control our action. You could watch any kind of mob scene going on, and you could tell what's in control of those people's actions. Some of very high vibration, and in other cases, it's, you know, kind of like a mindless mob. If you and I were going on a car trip, most likely we would fill the gas tank before we start. Why? Because it's convenient. It's convenient to start on a car trip with full tank of gas, fully fueled, fully energized. And that way we can go kind of, several hundred miles before we have to stop for gas again. So that's convenient. But we can do the same thing for ourselves when we are going to take on a thinking exercise, have to make business decisions about a project or something of the sort. Or we're going to deal with something that is emotional. So it's an emotional trip or a communications requirement, something we've got to talk about or address with somebody else. Or there's a physical response to a demand. Something needs to be done. We've got to do it. So this one simple filtering question could give us great insight. Do I believe I have enough energy to be successful doing fill in the blank? Do I believe I have enough energy to be successful at this? Do I have enough energy to think I can do this effectively? If the belief comes back to you as a no, then connect to the source of all energy, capital S, capital A, capital E, until you get that yes. And if the answer is a yes already, take action in gratitude. Gratitude keeps us open to this energy flow that sustains us. We have enough energy. We have enough energy. We have divine energy at our beck and call. All we have to do is reach out in thought and feeling to it and ask for it. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8 in the book Christ Returns, Reveal Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought us into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.